Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 14th of March. We talk about animal minds this hour of our program. I love all of our conversations, but I've been particularly looking forward to this one. Inside Animal Minds is the cover story of National Geographic for the month of March. Birds, apes, dolphins, and a dog with a world-class vocabulary. And we're talking with two of the prominent researchers who are featured in this article. Dr. Irene Pepperberg is a cognitive psychologist at Brandeis University and founder of the Alex Foundation. You'll find out who Alex was in just a moment. She's also working at Harvard University, and she studies gray parrots, the main focus of her work to determine the cognitive and communicative abilities of these birds and compare them with those of great apes, marine mammals, and also young children. And she's studying the mechanisms of their learning as well as the outcomes. The article starts like this. In 1977, Irene, a recent graduate of Harvard, did something very bold. At a time when animals were still considered automatons, she set out to find out what was on another creature's mind by talking to it. And she brought a one-year-old African gray parrot that she named Alex into her lab to teach him to reproduce the sounds of the English language. She says, "I thought if he learned to communicate, I could ask him questions about how he sees the world." She spent many years talking with Alex, and Alex talked with her as well. Alex died last September at the age of 31, and we're very happy to have Dr. Irene Pepperberg with us the first half hour of our program. The second half hour, we will go to the University of Cambridge to a professor who has been working with sheep. We welcome your phone calls, as we always do. I think we'll get a few on this topic. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Dr. Irene Pepperberg, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
The article made me want to be with you when you were with Alex. I just wanted to drop in and spend a day with you because it would have been so fascinating. And you must miss him.
It is very hard. It has been very, very hard. Fortunately, we have two younger birds who are learning and slowly getting there, but it's still very hard to see that empty cage.
I'm sure it is. So tell me, what were you thinking of doing back in 1977, and how did you find Alex? And you picked Alex for a certain reason.
Yes, yes. I decided to work on gray parrots because some work had already been done in Germany on their both communicative and intelligent abilities. And I really wanted to try to replicate the kinds of work that was being done with apes and dolphins, but with an animal that could talk so that anybody could walk into the lab and communicate with him and ask questions.
Mm-hmm. And did people think you were crazy?
Yes, yes.
I'll bet they did.
Yeah. Again, as you pointed out, at the time that I started this work, animal minds were not something one really talked much about. And if you were working with an animal, you worked with an ape, which had a close genetic relationship to humans, so there was some hope that you'd get some interesting data,
mm-hmm.
or large-brained dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a bird with the size of a shell, brain the size of a shelled walnut.
Goodness.
And there was a lot of skepticism. My first grant proposal came back, and the reviews were essentially asking me what I was smoking.
You just ignored them and carried on, and good for you. The article says that scientists thought, of course, at that time that chimps were better subjects, but of course, this is an interesting point, chimps can't speak.
Right, right. And that was the beauty of working with a parrot.
Mm-hmm. So you talked to Alex, and you talked, and you talked, and you talked. Talking was a big thing so that Alex could imitate some of the sounds, right?
Well, we did more than just talk. We used what was called the model rival technique, which was actually developed initially by a German scientist, Professor Dietmar Todt, and it basically demonstrated to the bird the types of behaviors, vocal behaviors, we wanted it to learn. We've adapted Dietmar's technique quite a bit, but the basic idea is the same. We also use what we call referential rewards, meaning that we trained Alex to label a particular object, and that object was his reward if he said the label.
Hmm.
So there was a one-to-one correspondence between the object and the label to be learned. And the way we did it was I have an object that he really wanted. He'd be on a perch. I'd show it to my student, who was the model for his behavior and his rival for my attention.
Hmm.
And I'd say, you know, "What's this?" And she'd say, "Key." And parrots like to scratch themselves with the key. They can reach places that are a little hard. And I'd give her the key, and we'd go, "Key, key, that's right, it's a key, key, you've got the key." And then we'd exchange roles of model, rival, and trainer, so the bird would see that one person was wasn't always a questioner and the other person the respondent, but it was interactive. She'd show it to me, and instead of saying key this time, I'd go, rack, and she'd go, no, you're wrong. So the bird would see that not any weird noise mediated transfer of the object, but only the correct one. I got another chance. I got it right. And it was very important that we both exchange the roles and make these errors so he understood what was and was not acceptable. And then we'd ask him, and of course he couldn't say it initially, but initially he'd say something like E, and we'd say that's right, and we'd give it to him and then shape the behavior up appropriately.
Interesting. This is fairly sophisticated on the part of this parrot, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But interestingly, these techniques have been adapted by my colleague in California, Diane Sherman, for work with autistic children.
Really? How so?
Children who don't have communicative skills tend to not understand what these sounds mean. Hmm. Not just, I mean, there's a whole constellation of deficits in some of these children. And in all cases, the children's success sort of depends on, you know, where they're starting. So we don't get a child who had absolutely no language talking the way you and I are talking. But each child that Diane has worked with has made significant progress.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the breadth of Alex's understanding about numbers, shapes, and colors. It's really quite extraordinary.
Yes, we trained him to identify he got 7 colors. He learned 5 shapes. We called them 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 cornered. We worked on numbers as well. He understood numbers from 1 to 6. It was only a few years before he passed, though, that we really had data for counting, which is different from just perceiving numbers. I mean, think about dominoes and dice. You say how many dots there are, but you're not counting them. You just have a perception.
Yes, right.
So we had to separate that ability from literally counting things. Mm. And we were able to do that. And just before he died, we completed a paper. We didn't complete the paper. We completed the data collection on a paper that will show that he understood 7 and 8.
But had a hard time saying it because birds don't have lips. Parrots don't have lips.
Right. So for a long time, we had one or snun, which sounds stupid, but then think, seven, snun. He was putting together what he had in his repertoire, the sound, as well as none or one, in an attempt to get it. And again, just before he died, we got 7, which was a b sound, which was his first approximation for that b sound.
Huh. And he also, this is astounding to me, would reprimand another bird for not speaking clearly.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
I think he just enjoyed interrupting Griffin's sessions to get some attention for himself. But be that as it may, he'd tell Griffin to talk clearly or say better. And also when we'd be training Griffin on something like color, he'd butt in and say, no, you tell me, what shape? And Griffin would look to him and to me and, you know, sort of shrug his little parrot shoulders and, you know, as though, who am I supposed to answer?
He was kept inside, but he knew about a tree that was down the hall from both of your office.
Yeah, we had, in every place we've been, of course, the laboratory, for safety reasons, has been windowless pretty much. But usually there was always been some place, some little corridor, end of a corridor, or some area where there were trees and you could see outside. And, of course, we had to be very careful when we took him there. It had to be mostly after hours or times when it wasn't too busy. And he learned to say, go see tree, to ask us to be taken out of the room to go to those places. And that, of course, was a treat.
Hmm. What does it mean, and I'm wondering if this we can make generalizations about other animals who have some of these remarkable signs of intelligence. The article says, parrots like great apes and humans live a long time in complex societies. These birds must keep track of the dynamics of changing relationships and environments. Let's start with a long time. Do you have to live a long time as an animal to be able to develop some of this intelligence?
It's not an absolute requirement, but it helps because being alive for a long time means you have to update information over the course of your life. Not just remember that, oh, there are fruiting trees here, but remember that over the course of your lifetime, there may be new fruiting trees someplace else, or the first one may die. Okay? The same is true of relationships among the group. You know, Sam beat up on Joe and Joe beat up on me. I better not go near Sam. That may be true when you're a juvenile, but, you know, 20 years down the road, Sam may no longer be around. Joe may no longer be around. Mm-hmm. There may be a whole different dominance hierarchy, and you have to learn to update that and figure out your place as things change.
Alex really liked boys, didn't he?
He did.
Why was that?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure what it was. Some suggestions that people have made is that it depends on who might have hand-raised the bird at the beginning, and there's a little bit of an imprinting on that, but we don't really know. I know he did particularly like tall boys, tall men. So he would climb up on their shoulders and like to, you know, wander around the room sitting up high.
And you two would be in the office pretty much all day together. Did you talk a lot?
Yes. This was at the beginning before I was teaching and going to conferences and all that stuff. And we would because, you know, I'd ask him to identify something and he'd, you know, say "air" initially for paper. And then he'd sit and chew it for 15 minutes. And during that time, I'd say, "It's paper. You've got the paper. It's white paper." You know, and I would make up these little sentences. We call them sentence frames that you use with children, and emphasizing this word paper over and over again so he would hear the correct pronunciation. Hmm. And we do that, of course, with the junior birds, too.
And he actually practiced as well. It was like, you know, you would try to get your child to practice the piano. Alex would practice the sounds.
Yes, he would do that sometimes in our presence. But lots of times he would do this in the evenings.
Oh.
Now, it's interesting. There's a 1962 book by Ruth Weir called Crib Talk, where she put a tape recorder by her son's crib and found out in the, you know, 20 minutes or 15 minutes before he fell asleep, he would practice what he had heard during the day.
Huh.
And so we did this with Alex. We put a tape recorder in his room and taped him in the half hour before the lights went completely off, and in the morning when the dawn light came on and before the major lights came on. And he would do the same thing. He would practice those labels.
My. And do you think that we might practice them in our sleep as well?
Well, that's a whole other story that some people are actually working on with birds and bird song, that there seems to be some consolidation during sleep.
Interesting. So back in 1977, people thought you were crazy. What do they think of what you've learned now?
Well, I think there are some people who still have trouble believing it, but there is much more acceptance in the scientific community, and many more people are appreciating what we've done and are looking at other birds in different ways and carrying on the work with other birds and other species.
Mm. And what does it mean? I mean, it's a big thing. What does it mean for human beings?
Well, there are two reasons that it's important for human beings. First is that we can look at a brain that is organized so differently. Well, it's not organized that differently from ours, we know now, but it functions the same way even though it looks different from ours. But it still functions the same way. And that makes us appreciate that this creature, you know, a brain the size of, as I said before, a shelled walnut, can do the same types of tasks as young children. That makes us have to appreciate the abilities of other animals with which we share the world.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue is that, particularly because of this autism work, these birds and possibly other animals become very good models in which to test out different techniques and see what might be working that we could transfer into the paradigm for working with children with disabilities.
Mm. Do these abilities, Dr. Pepperberg, transfer to other kinds of birds?
Well, there's so much stuff now being done, and I say stuff, which, you know, is not a scientific term. But if you look at the work by, you know, the original work by Camel and Balda on the caching behavior of the nutcrackers and the larger birds out in the Southwest, now people like Clayton and her lab in Cambridge have been working on episodic-like memory in these birds so that they learn not just what they store and where they store it, but when they store it. People like Alex Kaselnik at Oxford looking with New Caledonian crows and all sorts of fancy tool use, as well as people who have been working for years on orientation and homing and issues like that. There's so much that we need to know. All the bird song work, I mean, that's getting more and more sophisticated.
Yeah.
How they learn their songs, from who do they learn their songs?
Oh, yes.
What's important for learning songs, what these songs may mean. You know, we've been working on bird song for 40 years, and we're just beginning to understand what these songs may mean for these birds.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about the birds you're working with now.
Okay, there's Griffin, who will turn 13 next month.
Oh, my.
Yes, and then there's Arthur, who's 9. He was 9 in October. And Griffin is the bird that we got at 7.5 weeks old. So we have been working with him all of his life.
Hmm.
He was doing very, very well when he had his own little space when we were in Tucson. And then for the last few years, Alex has been interrupting all of his sessions. So he's learned some things from Alex, but there's been that problem of that interruption. So he's not where, and we also for many years were doing studies on how they learned their labels. So we tried out with Griffin and some other birds in, when we were in Tucson, different types of training techniques that didn't work at all. Things like just giving them audio tapes of the sounds we wanted them to learn, mm-hmm. or showing them videotapes of Alex's sessions, or working without two trainers but just one trainer, various things like that that didn't really work that well. So he was not at the stage that Alex was at his age because of all this almost 10 years of not really, you know, good training. And I have to say that he's just beginning to come out of, I would call it a little bit of a shell shock, of, you know, still looking to Alex's cage to see, hey, you know, you were the one, you interrupted everything, you told me all the answers. In fact, last night we just got a little breakthrough of him learning a new label, so that was exciting.
Yeah. So when you look at all of them, we do this with human beings all the time, we classify them and we think of ourselves as being smart or not very smart, or smart in certain areas and not very smart in others. Can you discern a difference in intelligence among all of these birds?
I think there are differences in intelligence, just like with humans. I mean, the youngest bird, Arthur, we got him when I was at the media lab to work on animal-human-computer interfaces. We called it InterPet Explorer. It was supposed to be a kind of a web browser that the birds could use while they were alone during the day. And he really, really got into working with these computer systems, which we now are no longer doing.
Oh, my gosh.
And so he's much less interested in learning labels. I think he will come up, you know, when we now have more time to work with him. Again, now we're only working with two birds instead of three, so they get each one gets an extra session each day.
What in the world was he doing on the computer?
Well, he was able to choose the kinds of input he wanted. So there was one way of coming up and saying, okay, I want to listen to music versus I want to see videos.
Wow.
And another thing would say of the music, you know, do you want to listen to classical? Do you want to listen to, you know, rock? Do you want to listen to jazz? Things like that. So.
And what did he choose? All of them?
It depended. You know, when we put Alex on this, he really liked classical or things with a good beat. and Arthur really liked a lot of things with a good beat. They really liked that.
And what did you like? I wonder if it all conflicted.
I had, you know, that was the point. I was not allowed to make the choice.
You had their choice. Right.
Yeah, it was their choice.
Oh, that's fascinating. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our first guest, Dr. Irene Pepperberg. She studies gray parrots, and she is at Brandeis, and she's also working at Harvard University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Her story outlined in National Geographic, the month of March, Inside Animal Minds, Birds, Apes, Dolphins, and a Dog, with a world-class vocabulary. And so we'll be with your phone calls. The actual article itself is titled Minds of Their Own, Animals Are Smarter Than You Think. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dr. Pepperberg, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like, and that number is, that's not a number, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Jeff from Mount Horeb is our first caller. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. What a fascinating conversation, and the work that you've done, Doctor, just amazing, the dedication. I want to commend you for taking the time and the years. I was thinking, as you were talking about the, I don't remember the parrot's names, but the one who had been interrupted by Charlie and just didn't seem like he was learning quite as fast. And I'm wondering, when I think about my own desires to learn languages or just to learn in general and my intellectual curiosity, and you compare that to your peers and people have different propensities, I know it'd be difficult to indicate in a parrot, but is it possible that there are just some parrots who don't want to learn language? They're not intellectually curious, and you would always just have a hard time getting them to learn language?
Yes, I think if you look at our youngest bird, as I was mentioning, he much prefers to, you know, work on the computer, which we aren't doing now, play with toys. He will communicate with us, but he's much less interested than Griffin or Alex. So I think there is this you know, range, just like in people.
Fascinating. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Look forward to finding out, learning more about this project. It's been great.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Do you have a special website so people can find out more about your work, Irene?
Yes, it's www.alexfoundation.org.
alexfoundation.org.
.org. Yes.
Okay. Great. Let's go next to William from Green Bay. Hi, William.
Hi. There's a little zoo up in Menominee, Michigan called the Young Family Zoo, and they have a couple of parrots. They're not gray parrots, but they're like white parrots. Or cockatoos, I'm not sure, but I was told that one of them could pick locks, and actually told one of the other birds to shut up.
Oh, I can believe that of a cockatoo. I have friends of mine who have combination locks on the doors of their cockatoo cages because the birds have broken through all the human-type easy locks, and have also said that they've seen the bird hold the lock in one foot and then use its beak to twirl combination lock.
Really?
You know, not having, I guess, understood the mechanism, but seeing the people do that and thinking there must be something to this. So, yes, I'm not at all surprised with cockatoos.
And tell me about how you've used imitation.
In terms of using the bird's abilities to reproduce our sounds.
I see.
And imitation, people have to separate mimicry and imitation. Sounds like it's the same thing, but it's not. Mimicry is when you're sort of mindlessly repeating something, whereas imitation is when you have a goal in learning to reproduce something for a particular reason in a particular way. And we use our birds, you know, mimetic abilities, and then we channel them into an imitative form.
Thank you, William. Kathy is next from Viroqua. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because about 50 years ago or so, when I was a little girl, we had parakeets at home, one at a time as pets. And just by us talking to these birds, and maybe not all of them, but I remember one saying a lot of what we would be saying to it. And I had heard then that maybe there was a window of opportunity in parakeets' development where they could develop that ability. So this, you know, we had parakeets saying, "Where's Mama? Here's Kathy. Happy birthday. Merry Christmas." Whatever we would say to it.
Right.
And so, I mean, we didn't do this scientifically or anything, but I just, you know, based on the topic you're talking about, I wondered.
Yeah, well, I got into this by having parakeets as a child that did talk in just that way. All parrots are what we call open-ended learners, and they actually can learn throughout their lives. We think it may be a little bit easier when they're younger, but essentially they can learn throughout their lives.
Yes, thanks, Kathy, very much for your call. Gandals, is it, from Wales? Hi.
Hi, it's actually Fran. Our parrot is named Gandalf.
Oh, I'm... Excuse me, how could I get so confused?
Quite a talker. And I actually met Dr. Pepperberg several years ago at a conference in Durham. I'm also an experimental psychologist. And my husband and I got an African gray parrot when he was about 9 weeks home, 9 weeks old. We brought him home, and we've been working with him to learn his colors. So he understands red, and so he can generalize that the flower is red, to the apple is red, and so forth. But he did something remarkable a couple of months ago that I just wanted to share with you. He's potty trained, so when he needs to go, when he comes out of his cage, we always take him over to his little potty. Just like any baby, sometimes he has an accident. So he had flown to us in the kitchen and was sitting on the chair, and he pooped. And I said to him, "Gandalf, did you poop?" And he said, "No, Mommy, it was Osiris." And Osiris is one of our cats.
Oh!
So he actually lied.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that something?
It was amazing.
Oh, that is something.
It's really funny when you think of what actually goes into that, you know, not only understanding what I'm saying and what it means, but projecting it onto another animal.
Right. And so what's the punishment for lying for a parrot?
We don't have one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We praised him because we were just so excited that he said that.
Right.
It's quite a story. Thanks very much for calling. We're going to switch guests here in a moment, but I'm just interested, you've spent all these years with gray parrots. What other animals do you find fascinating in terms of their intelligence?
Oh, any kind of bird.
Really?
I'm really fascinated by the birds, yeah. And again, that's just a personal twitch. But
right.
just watching them in the wild and seeing what they're doing and trying to figure out why they're doing it and what, you know, reasons are there and how they're learning fascinates me, as well as the work in the laboratory.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, it's just a profoundly interesting article. And the picture in the magazine is a picture of Alex?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What an absolutely beautiful bird.
Yeah. And he's actually blushing a little bit there, which that pink area is normally white, but when they get very excited, it starts to turn a little bit pink. And he was obviously, you know, excited by the whole photographic process.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just stare at the picture, can't you, for a long time?
Yes, yes. Mm. And they actually, National Geographic, sent me a large copy of it, which is really special.
Oh, and always will be.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Dr. Irene Pepperberg, and we're just switching guests here, same topic. She is a cognitive psychologist at Brandeis University, and she is founder of the Alex Foundation. She also is at Harvard University, and she studies and has for a number of years gray parrots, the focus of her work determining the cognitive and communicative abilities of these birds and to compare their abilities with those of great apes, marine mammals, and young children. She is studying the mechanisms of their learning as well as the outcomes. And if you want to go to alexfoundation.org, you can get more information about this absolutely fascinating topic, alexfoundation.org. We're changing guests now, and our next guest has done a great deal of work with sheep, of all animals, Professor Keith Kendrick, a professor of cognitive and behavioral neuroscience at the Babraham Institute at the University of Cambridge in England. Dr. Kendrick is a systems and behavioral neuroscientist who's applying behavioral, neurophysiological, and computational approaches to understanding how neural networks are organized to control recognition of social and emotional cues. He's interested in investigating social odors and faces and the impact of learning. He has done a great deal of work, and his current work involves recording techniques in rodents in terms of smell and sheep in terms of face recognition, and the development of computational and statistical approaches to analyze and ultimately model neural network encoding strategies. In the magazine, there is a picture of Edward. Edward's got quite a face, and Edward is a sheep. And he... And the article goes like this: tell sheep they all look alike and they may beg to differ. Like primates, sheep in studies recognize different faces, about 50 other sheep and 10 humans, and they still know them 2 years later. They are calmed by familiar faces, and they can tell both happy and angry expressions, and they prefer the former. They are sophisticated. These are sophisticated abilities in an animal that's usually, we don't think of sheep as being smart. And our guest, of course, will beg to differ. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Kendrick. Our number remains the same, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Email is talk@wpr.org. Professor Keith Kendrick, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's good afternoon for me, but I guess it's morning for you, isn't it?
It is morning, but almost afternoon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Why did you decide to start? Well, I know you do rodents, but why the interest in sheep?
Oh, well, it actually started when a part of my research career I was working on the control of maternal behavior. And sheep actually have a very strong maternal response, and they bond with their lambs. And so they were a very interesting model to look at, the sort of whole process of how maternal behavior is controlled by the brain, and also, of course, this bonding between mother and offspring. But one of the things that came out of that general area of research when I was sort of looking into it was that some work had been done, in fact, in my same institute about 5 years before I arrived here, so back in the sort of late 1970s, which had shown that mother ewes or mother sheep, when they are trying to recognize their lambs, normally they use smell to start with, and everybody's sort of known about that for some time. But for some reason or another, they found that if you actually discolored the appearance of the face, that the mothers didn't recognize their lambs anymore.
Oh, my.
So it suggested that actually sheep were paying attention to visual cues from the face to recognize one another. And they have a very, very good visual system. And that kind of started off a whole train of experiments which tried to work out, A, whether they were capable of recognizing faces, and also, B, whether they could do it in the same way that humans do. And when I say that, I also mean that there are specialized parts of the human brain that deal with this very important social function. And so we wanted to find out whether sheep were just the same.
And yet we have this these thoughts about sheep as being stupid, don't we?
Yeah, we certainly do.
Yes.
And I mean, the kind of things that I'm describing in sheep are almost certainly present in a large variety of other mammals, and certainly in domestic animals, and I'm sure they're present in at least dogs as well. But yes, if you take a lowly sheep, which people don't really expect is anything more than a grass-eating robot, and you suddenly show that they have a highly sophisticated mechanism in their brain that was thought to have only evolved in a primate brain, and certainly has reached its most sophisticated in humans, mm-hmm. which is this ability to recognize hundreds or even perhaps thousands of different faces, and of course not just the who they are, but also what they're feeling, so also emotional expressions and so forth. And to suddenly show that sheep have this opens up an immediate question. Well, you don't have that kind of thing unless you have quite a sophisticated social environment, and you need to be able to recognize what other animals are actually feeling and thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can call that intelligence if you like, and because they have a fantastic memory associated with it, they'll remember faces as we do for a very, very long time. But really what it's showing is they have a very complex social and emotional life, which isn't necessarily easy to see when you just look at them out on a field full of grass.
Mm-hmm. And how strong a thing is memory in terms of being pretty intelligent?
Well, it's right up there, of course. It's not the only thing, but if you can't remember anything, and especially if you can't remember things for a very long period of time, then you are somewhat limited. But, even quite simple organisms have quite robust memories. So you have to look in the sort of context in which they are using them. In this case, really what we're doing is revealing a complex social side of a sheep's life that perhaps previously nobody would have ever given them credit for.
Right. And once you learn that obviously leads to some fairly profound thoughts about sheep and animals and relationships between sheep and human beings and sheep and other sheep and why they have this form of intelligence. What do you think about all of it?
Well, obviously, to a large extent, the reason that I work on sheep is to try and understand similar processes going on in humans, and particularly, obviously, in the human brain. So for them to show very similar kinds of social and emotional recognition systems does really establish them quite quickly as being a bona fide way of trying to understand what may be going on in, admittedly, a far more complex human brain. So at the same time, of course, you turn around and say, well, actually, these are not grass-eating robots. These are sentient, emotional beings, and we must treat them accordingly.
Interesting. Which means changing the way we treat them in some way?
It means a number of things, actually. And of all the farmed animal species that we have, perhaps sheep get the best deal. There are certain areas where they don't, but primarily, of course, they're kept outside, so they're not kept in restricted environments. But it does mean that you have to start thinking about their social environment, not just mixing and matching different sheep and not paying attention to their sort of social stability in the same way you would with ourselves. And they, one of the things we discovered once we found they had this quite amazing face recognition skill. I mean, they can distinguish the difference between very, very similar looking faces, and they can also recognize human faces. But the next step, once we found how good they were at doing it, they have a very good visual acuity, was to say, okay, can they recognize emotion cues?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first things we found was they could actually tell the difference between smiling and angry human faces.
Mm.
And that was something that perhaps people wouldn't have immediately thought about, that somehow or other the sheep could tell whether their stock person was having a bad day or was actually threatening them or so forth. You know, but they clearly can from the facial expression. So that's sort of, you know, you have to pay attention as to
really
your emotional interactions with your animals. I mean, a lot of animal carers will tell you that anyway.
Sure.
And they have other ways of picking up emotional signals, obviously, particularly through smell. They are very, very good at picking up emotional signs from other animals as well as from humans. But it's kind of interesting that they can use the same cues that we do,
right,
from these quite subtle emotional expressions. And in fact, if you look at the face of a sheep, although they don't have the same kind of facial expressions that we do, they do actually have quite subtle changes that go on in the appearance of their face. Their ears tend to sort of flatten when they're stressed, for example, or anxious. Their ears tend to flatten back a bit, and their eyes show far more of the whites, and their nostrils can often flare. These are tiny, tiny changes, but the animals can pick up on them, and we can learn to pick up on them too.
So if you're in a bad mood and the sheep knows you pretty well, does their behavior change? Do they move away from you? Or
Yes. I mean, the assumption is they do, but what we simply did was to take the same person and take their face when they were either angry or smiling, and the sheep simply had to indicate a choice of one of those two pictures. We train them so that they actually use their noses to press, like sort of touch panels, so that they can indicate which picture they're choosing. And depending on how we set it up, touching one panel associated with one picture will get them a food reward, and touching the wrong picture won't. But in this case, we said, okay, both are right, it's the same individual, so you'll get food whichever panel you press. But one is a smiling version and one is an angry version of the same individual. And under those circumstances, when they first get presented with the task, they will avoid the pressing the panel associated with the angry face, and they will press the panel associated with the smiling one. And that's the same for whether it's a human face or, in fact, whether it's a sheep face. But obviously we can't make sheep smile or necessarily be angry. So in this case, it's the difference between the face of a calm, sort of relaxed version of the same animal and a stressed, anxious one, because, you know, it's been isolated and there's no one around and its heart rate's sort of gone up and it's stressed.
We're going to welcome phone calls and we'll take them in a moment. Professor Keith Kendrick is our guest now, and he has, he's a systems and behavioral neuroscientist. He is at the University of Cambridge, and our number is 800-486-8655. Our conversation this hour, Inside Animal Minds, and we also have an email if you'd like to send us one of those. That would be okay. That is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dr. Keith Kendrick, and we start with Julie from River Falls. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is Julie Kenefick. I live just a little bit to the east of the Twin Cities in River Falls, and I raise Navajo Churro sheep, which I'm not sure if Dr. Kendrick is familiar with that breed. They are still on the rare and endangered list. They're considered a feral or unimproved breed. And
okay.
Over the
14, I'm not familiar with them, but yes, go on. Listen,
yes.
Go, off
and
you go.
Over the 14 years that I have raised them, I have noticed some remarkable behavior, particularly in the area of emotion. In particular, if there are twins born, and in one case I had one twin male dying. He was ill, and his mate went and laid next to him when he was so sick. And the other time I sold a wether, you know, the castrated male, and his pal, who had been with him a lot, really went into a depression, was in the corner of the barn area for a couple of days, and I was really concerned about his lack of wanting to eat. I've also had, as most sheep people will tell you, I've had lambs in the house, and I had one lamb in the house so long, and he had watched us open the back door so often that by the time he got a little older, he would put his nose up to try to bring the lever down on the doorknob. Yeah, so we've had some remarkable experiences with these sheep.
I guess you have.
Yes, I can see. I can understand all of these. In fact, I've heard hundreds of them, and actually very often sheep pining for humans as well. You know, once someone who's been with them for a long time goes away. I've had one lady sort of tell me of a circumstance where she actually left this ram in this country and went to the United States, and she didn't come back for 3 years. And when she did, the ram recognized and greeted her enthusiastically immediately, and he went into a major decline sort of for the first few months that she actually left in the first place.
Oh my. But when you look at, I've heard, we've interviewed people on bonobos several times on this show, and the Milwaukee County Zoo has a couple of bonobos that came from the Netherlands, and the people who had initially raised them came back. This story astounded me. 40 years later, and the bonobos recognize them.
Yes. The thing is these kind of social memories that obviously have a very strong emotional context tend to last for a very, very long time, if not forever, especially when they are developed early on. And so, for example, one of the areas that we worked on, which perhaps illustrates this extremely well, is obviously a mother and lamb have a very strong bond between them. Normally we focus on the bond that the mother forms for its lamb, but obviously it works the other way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions we asked some years ago now was just how much influence does mum have on various important things in your life, like who you find socially and sexually attractive, as well as, you know, what you like to eat and these kinds of things. And anyway, the bottom line is that the bond with the mother seems to be highly influential on the kind of individual that you will find socially and sexually attractive when you actually grow up. This is called sexual imprinting. The way we did it was to actually swap between sheep and goats, so you ended up having sheep being raised by goats and vice versa, and then seeing what species they actually preferred to socialize and mate with when they grew up.
Huh.
But they always had their own species around, so it's not, you know, sort of making it impossible for them to ever recognize their own kind or anything like that. So it's just an illustration of how powerful and formative that early emotional bond with mother is for sheep, and it's just the same way it is for humans.
Yes. Hmm. Thank you, Julie, so much for the call. Virginia is next from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, to you and your guest, the professor. For one thing, I wanted to comment that I don't think I will ever think of sheep quite in the same way as simply mere followers, you know, of the
won't either. I won't either.
Well, we've achieved something then.
Fascinating about that. Now, the other comment I wanted to make is about a book that I have here in front of me, and I got it about eight years ago, I guess, and the title of it is Beautiful Jim Key, and that is K-E-Y,
right.
As on a key ring. And this book is concerned, it tells us here, the lost history of a horse and a man who changed the world. Now, this horse was very intelligent. He came on the scene in 1897 here down in Tennessee. And he was just they thought he was just a regular horse, you know, that was born there. And he started following, his master around, who was this ex-slave, which was a self-taught veterinarian. He called himself, a doctor, but so they called him Dr. Jim Key. So then they gave the horse that same name, Jim Key. This horse learned how to tell time by the doctor's gentle training. He was patient with the horse, and he showed kindness to him. So I guess what it's saying is through this whole book, it's a hardbound book here, fascinating, beautiful pictures, too, black and white, of the horse and the doctor. And he took him all around this country, the United States, and I think that he may have gone to other countries, too, but mainly in this country, he took him to schools.
Mm.
So that children could learn from, actually learn from the horse and learn how patience and kindness to work with animals this way.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kendrick.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes, the patience, you can achieve an amazing amount in training an animal just with what we would call positive reinforcements, which is basically patience and kindness and food and, you know, all the things that they like. But really, I mean, we're primarily in the business of bringing out what they do naturally, and not necessarily what we could make them do. You know, they're obviously, you can make them do circus tricks, you can make them do all sorts of things if you want, but really what we're trying to do is to discover what they do during the normal course of their lives. And, of course, you get very, very big individual differences as well. I mean, I have sort of had superstar sheep who just frankly could do anything as far as whatever we threw at them. They had no problem dealing with it. But then, others have just couldn't do it at all. So, I mean, yeah, they're just like humans. You get a huge amount of variation between between one animal and another. And, if you show any animal species, but particularly one like a sheep, which is a prey animal that is fearful of pretty much its own shadow and therefore is easily spooked and stressed and so forth, and therefore that's why they tend to look stupid. Okay, but once you get over that, once they trust you and they are calm in your presence and they attend to whatever it is that you're asking them to do and that you are rewarding them for doing it, it's quite amazing what they can do. And if I was just to say, well, okay, this show you different brains from a dog, a cat, any kind of farm animal, we had our own sort of bias in saying, well, obviously the sheep's got to have something wrong with it, it's got to have a simple brain. You look at the brain and you think, God, that has to be an intelligent creature. It's a very complicated brain. That's what it looks like. So it's not terribly surprising that once we actually create the right conditions where the animal is really going to be able to show us what it can do, that it is quite an intelligent, sentient and emotional being.
Thank you, Virginia. Lori is next from Genoa City. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I'm so glad the professor's on because he validates all the things that I know that get me crazy looks from everyone else. I have a question about racism in sheep.
Racism in sheep. Yes, okay, fine. I can see where you're coming from.
Okay.
We have Katahdins, and they're all different colors, dark, white, spotted. And we had two last year, one dark, one white. Both had twins. Twins were both white, one full white, one full dark. They tried to kill their baby that did not match their coloring. They tried to bash them against the barn. It was very upsetting. We tried all the advice of smell. Put the afterbirth on the baby. Get the mother to smell that it's her baby. None of that worked. We had to stanchion them, actually tie them up like a witch in Salem for months to let the baby still nurse. And I don't know if any of your research goes to their recognition of color of other sheep.
Okay.
There has been some work, actually, which shows that they're capable of distinguishing individuals on the basis of coat color. We tended to use pure white sheep with very homogeneous looking faces in order to make it it hard. So we deliberately avoided piebald type sheep or anything like that. So to a large extent, I can't answer your question because of the sheep breeds we use. You don't get that kind of color variation. all I can say is that we've done this this fostering study that I mentioned a bit earlier during the interview, where we actually were cross-fostering between species. So we were actually getting maternal ewes to look after goat kids. And the goat kids in this case were white, and the sheep were when they come out were actually dark. They were you know, almost jet black. And yes, we did have a little bit of trouble, but of course it's a different species as well, and they smell different. But we managed to get over any rejection problems. And one of the reasons we can do that is because I know what you mentioned, which was the, you know, the odor transfer thing. In our experience, it doesn't work very well. And we discovered, actually, right at the beginning when I started working on sheep and we were looking at how
almost out of time
their maternal behavior is controlled, we actually found that the signals from the vagina and cervix affect the brain, and they are the things that make them maternal. And they release a particular peptide called oxytocin.
Thank you, Dr. Kendrick, so much for I hate to interrupt you, but we are out of time. What a fascinating hour. And you can read more. National Geographic, Inside Animal Minds, Birds, Apes, Dolphins, and a Dog with a World-Class Vocabulary. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing this highly interesting show. John Treader for On Air Production. Thanks for listening.